Hello and welcome to a podcast on fire, a Richard Norton interview. I made good on a promise I made to myself and to you listeners, I suppose, that post the big 200th episode, I said on the show in the various recordings that I would pursue more interviews. We haven't done one in a long, long, long time. And for some reason, the name Richard Norton popped into my head when I'm thinking of reigniting this minute feature on the network that I hope to make a little bit more extensive. Not that Mr. Norton is an easy get to anything, but he's a legend, and he's been around to experience the golden era of Hong Kong action cinema, but that's just part of his massive and still ongoing story as a creator. So I'm going to leave you alone in a short bit so you can hear the interview, but you'll get some brief contact information first of all. And this is Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire Network. You have shows on Hong Kong cinema and interviews in this case, and shows on Japanese cinema, sleazy cinema, ninja cinema, Korean cinema, and bonus episodes as well. If you have any questions and feedback, we'd love to hear from you. podcastonfire@googlemail.com. At the top of our website, you'll find links to our Facebook, which will lead you to the discussion group, as well as to our Twitter and to our iTunes feed that you can subscribe to. And we would love to see a star rating from you and a written comment about what you think of the network or a particular show. You can also find links to our Stitcher presence, but the smoothest way to stream us on Stitcher is to download the applications available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. And without further ado, here go with the Richard Norton interview, and I hope you enjoy. So before we dive into it, our interview here with Richard Norton, on a personal level and on a sort of geeky level, I have to say thank you, not only for agreeing to the interview, but thank you, Mr. Norton, for returning to the Tex Murphy game universe, because I'm a great fan of the Tex Murphy adventure games for the PC, and you were recently in the Tesla Effect. So thank you very much for that, from a gamer's heart, so to say.
You're welcome.
I actually never got to Overseer at the time, because I remember the first game you appeared in, I remember my computer couldn't actually run the game, and then I didn't have a new computer for many, many years. I'm just now catching up on the entire series and have both Overseer and the Tesla Effect lined up, and you had a role in both, so I'm very much looking forward to that. So that was very cool. Like, that is you appearing in a gaming genre that is not hip or necessarily the norm nowadays, the video point-and-click adventure genre. So that is very cool, so thank you very much for that.
Well, you know, you're ahead of me, Kenneth, because I haven't seen either of them, to be honest, but because I'm not a gamer as such. You know, that all came about really from one of my oldest friends, you know, directing the actual both games and asked me to do it. And, you know, anything involves a little bit of a challenge and a different sort of situation, you know, for acting and everything is always fun. So, you know, I had a great time doing it.
Excellent, excellent. Well, let's do a proper intro, but his story and experiences, listeners, I'm going to let the man talk of himself. But I'm very pleased and hugely honored to be here with Australian martial artist, action film star, stuntman or stunt person, fight coordinator, once a bodyguard, and also martial arts trainer. So I properly welcome Mr. Richard Norton to Podcast on Fire. So good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Ken. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys.
Excellent, excellent. And I hope we gave ourselves a little bit of a challenge post our 200th episode that we were going to pursue interviews a little bit more. So you're the first interview that we've done in a long, long time. So thank you very much for agreeing to it. And let's start from the beginning. Sir, where were you born?
I was born in Melbourne, Australia. Melbourne is probably, you know, very much a southern sort of coast of Australia, right down the bottom there. In fact, you have Tasmania, and if you go any further, you end up in the South Pole. So we're on the other end of the earth.
Were you there for a city kid, me not knowing anything about Melbourne, if that's all big urban sprawl, or if it's a small, like, countryside aspects to it as well. So were you a city kid?
Yeah, no, I was a city kid. You know, most Australians are. I mean, obviously, there's lots that live out in the bush, as we call it, and out in the country. But, you know, nearly every capital city except for Alice Springs is on the coast in Australia. So we're all kind of coastal people, and the cities are quite large. You know, Melbourne itself is, goodness me, you know, if you count the whole of sprawl, it's over 5 million people. So it's not a small city. And, you know, you always look at Australia, the two major cities are Melbourne and Sydney. Melbourne and Sydney are a bit like Los Angeles and New York. There's always a bit of competition between the two cities. But where I was born was just out. I did live 20 miles out of the main sort of hub of the city, which when I grew up would have still been considered kind of the bush. You know, I say the bush, meaning more the country. You know, it's not recognizable from when I grew up there. And actually, my wife and I now live just basically 5 minutes out of the city of Melbourne in South Melbourne, which is nice. So we're still there. We're still Melbourne people.
Right on. But are you based more permanently out of Los Angeles the large majority of the year, or does your work habits mean you're all over the place the entire year?
Yeah, Kenneth, it depends. You know, we're always on the go. Look, Mel. You know, I always call Melbourne. You know, Melbourne's my home. Home. You know, obviously with friends and family and growing up there. But, you know, I've lived in Los Angeles for, goodness me, over 35 years. So
Right.
I'm probably more Californian than most Californians when it comes to that. You know, Los Angeles and the US was always sort of my work home. But as you know, in the industry of Miami, and you're always on the go. So who knows? You know, today I'm thinking I'm going to be here for a month, but tomorrow I could get a phone call and we're off to Timbuktu or who knows where. You know, so
Right.
you're never quite sure. And as you know, we'll get into that later. I just spent most of the year in Toronto, Canada. So.
And indeed, we'll get to that. But let me first ask you, where did sort of fitness and martial arts interest and desires stem from? Was this in your environment, or was there any kind of inspiration for you to get into martial arts, for instance?
No, it's been an often asked question. No, my environment wasn't or didn't have anything, you know, pertaining to martial arts. And I've said this before, and it's actually quite the truth. I reckon my introduction for martial arts was looking at ads on the back of comic books. You know, you used to have Donald Duck comics and all these sorts of things. And the one thing that struck me was these ads, you know, beat five people with a touch of a finger, all that sort of business. Even in hindsight, when I look back, I just remember being quite intrigued because back then martial arts had a very mystical kind of lure to it and connotation. You know, nowadays we know martial art is just something, it's another combat sport that just involves a lot of hard work and sweat and tears. But way back then, it was almost magical, you know, when you looked at the ads and you read about martial arts and you read, you know, Yama's book about breaking boards and bricks. It was, you know, for a young kid, that was a real eye-opener. And I was always quite fascinated with the idea. I didn't grow up in a rough neighborhood. It wasn't that I took up martial arts because I'm getting beaten up by the local gang or anything. That wasn't the case.
Right.
It's always very physical because we lived kind of in the country when I grew up. We were always out and about from morning till night, you know, chopping down trees, running in barefooted and wrestling. And of course, you know, major thing we were exposed to as kids then was boxing. So we're always playing around with that. And it's a kid called Morris Yeomans that moved into a house opposite where I lived. And we got to be friends and started hanging out. And initially I noticed he was disappearing two nights a week. And I asked him where he was going, and it turns out he was going to a judo class. And that was like, oh my goodness. I said, I want to go, you know. So I went along with Morris to this judo class, which was run by a police sergeant, you know, kind of in a church hall. And I started doing judo. I was 11 years of age then.
Wow.
Absolutely loved it, though I must say that as an 11-year-old, I was so skinny and small. And I was a bit like those cartoon characters getting chucked from one end of the dojo to the other by the older brown belts and
Right.
everything. One thing I did discover that those ads were a little misleading, that you could beat anybody with a flip of a finger. It certainly depended on how big they were and the size and skill level of them. But, you know, it was my introduction to martial arts and I was fascinated by it. And you know, and then that's really what started my martial arts journey. We had a friend that, you know, I went to high school with, was also learning karate in his garage at home. He had a, you know, kicking bag and everything, and he was literally learning out of Oyama's book. And I would go down there, and he'd show me little tricks, and he'd break boards and everything, and this is all self-taught. So again, I had an interest right from the get-go with what this particular guy, John Rowe, was doing. And it was during judo classes that John let us know that there was a karate school opening up about 3 miles from where I lived. Uh-huh. And I said, oh, wow, well, we've got to go and have a look. And I went and had a look at the opening night. It was a gentleman named Tino Sabarano who was teaching Goju Kai. And Tino was a Hawaiian Filipino. He'd been in the country in Australia maybe 6 months. He was an ex-Marine. And anyway, I went to this demonstration, and that just knocked my socks off. It was very simple. It was like H pattern forms, as we now know them, Taikyoka Joden, Chuden Geden, but basically an H pattern kata or form. For those who don't know, it's a series of choreographed moves, mm-hmm. you know, that more or less have the essence of the style in it. He did a little bit of sparring, which was called Jukumite, which is really just a controlled soft form of, you know, combat. And I just immediately recognized that as something that would suit me, in that it didn't involve strength and size. It was more about agility, and the size didn't come into it. So I joined up, and the rest is history. That started my real martial arts journey from there.
Does this lead you onto the competition circuit as well?
Well, it did, it, you know, but in a very minor way, and the reason being that it was so new. I mean, Tina was pretty much the pioneer of karate in Australia. There were a couple of people doing it, you know, but not to any large extent. So Tina introduced it. I did enter the very first ever Australian karate championships, and I ended up coming fourth in that.
Right on.
And even that's such a good memory for me, because I remember fighting, you know, for I came third in that. I remember fighting and thinking, oh, wow, you know, I'm all the way through and I'm going to place. And suddenly that's all that mattered to me. I almost gave up, you know. It was not so much gave up, but I reckon I could have won that thing. But I was so thrilled to just be actually placing. But, you know, that's a bit of history for me to be part of the first ever Australian championships.
Of course.
And keep in mind, you know, you're lucky to have one of those a year. It's not like, you know, Europe and in America, and of course, to a lesser extent, Australia, where there's some sort of tournament on just about every week. I mean, it was just an anomaly back then. So competition, again, was sparse, but still it was there. And, you know, I love the idea of it.
And at some point, you got into, if this is correct, you got into working as a bodyguard in your early 20s or something like that. And we actually share a minor Swedish connection there, because according to the information out there on the internet, is that you were a bodyguard at one point for a period of time for ABBA. But, you know, feel free to boast. Like, who were some of the greats you rubbed shoulders with in this profession?
Well, just to go back to the beginning of that, when I was still a teenager when I started doing door work, bouncers, we call them in Australia, doormen, security guards, and of course, people always laugh when I say I was in discos, because I've got friends that say, discos? I've never even heard that word. And I said, well, that's what they were called back then, but anyway.
I remember.
Yeah, and pubs and things, and I was just a teenager, and that came about. There was a gentleman named Bob Jones. Bob's 10 years older than me. He started Goju under Tino the same time as I did. And Bob was already running a reasonably large security agency. He did bodyguard work himself, you know, for businessmen and such, and basically had a lot of people on his books working the doors at different clubs. And it was through that I started working at different discos. We did a pop concert, which was our version of Woodstock in Australia some 35 years ago, whatever it is. And the pop concert was, you know, the entrepreneur that arranged it was a gentleman named Paul Dainty, who was one of our most prolific entrepreneurs, again, bringing acts out. And We worked for Paul. Paul ended up calling us up, and I'm paraphrasing now, of course, but he ended up calling up Bob and asking us if we would be interested in looking after the Rolling Stones when they were coming out. And this was in 1973. And of course, Bob said, yes. So Bob and I and a couple of other guys work with the Stones. And that was my introduction to bodyguarding work. It's quite a large introduction, to say the least.
Yeah, I was about to say, I mean, that's not something you fall into naturally, that every human is able to adjust to on the fly like that. I mean, it's a major duty that they're reliant on you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was incredible, you know, to be around artists of that caliber. I used to remember training Mick at 4 o'clock in the morning, teaching him reverse punches. You know, he's quite intrigued. Because, you know, you do a show, most of the time the act, they get all amped up and everything, they're all wide awake until 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
So we used to, you know, play around, you know, outside in the lobby and in their room and everything, and it was fantastic. It was just a really, really good experience. The best side of that for me was to actually get to know the artist other than what they allow the public to see and the persona that they kind of create for the public, to see and talk to them one-on-one as real people was just fantastic. Well, that sort of work then led on, you know, I want to say the bodyguard work, it's not the sort of thing where you send a headshot in and you have a bio and everything. It's about word of mouth. Because of working with him, and Paul Dainty then brought Fleetwood Mac out, Joe Cocker. You know, I work with Joe Cocker, Fleetwood Mac, Stevie Nicks, Linda Ronstadt, and James Taylor. I was with them for like 14 years. It was really, a lot of that work came from an act saying, you need to use this person. For instance, I remember being in New York with Linda Ronstadt. She's about to do Saturday Night Live, and I was giving a few stretches before the show because part of the attraction of using me was that I would most often get the band and a lot of times the acts doing martial arts, and I would try and keep them fit. In fact, Rolling Stone magazine did an article on me once talking about how some of the acts were coming off the road in better shape than they went on, which was unheard of back there, you know, and back then. So, you know, that was kind of funny. Anyways, I was giving Judy some, Linda some stretches in the dressing room, and John Belushi walked in and he saw that, and that was sort of history, because from then on, all he wanted was for me to work as his bodyguard.
Wow.
And I was pretty tied up with Fleetwood Mac at the time, and James and Linda, and, you know, I did, and I couldn't go out on tour with him, but I did end up working with John while he was making the Blues Brothers movie.
Mm-hmm.
Which again was amazing because I got to meet Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and
of course, all these yeah.
amazing people. And so anyway, but I was just illustrating that sort of work comes from somebody like John seeing with Linda, and he'd immediately go, oh, well, if Linda Ronstadt thinks he's good and the one you should have, then that's the one, you know, because it's so much about trust and confidence. Because as you can imagine, you know, I have adjoining rooms to all these people anywhere they go, so I'm well aware of everything that goes on a tour.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the last thing they want is somebody that's going to suddenly do a big article and, you know, cause all sorts of panic and everything with war stories of being on the road. And I always swore I would never do that. I realized I was a friend and a confidant, and I hated the idea of these kiss-and-tell books that basically dish out all the dirt of being on the road. So, and to finish off, yes, I did. Paul brought ABBA out to Australia, and they were as big as the Beatles in their day,
mm-hmm.
and in Australia was just massive. And I've got to tell you, I mean, you could not meet a nicer bunch of people. I'm such a fan in that. Even the girls, you know, they were so unaware of how, like, beautiful they were. They wouldn't wear makeup off the stage. They were just such regular people.
Yeah.
And, you know, which is very refreshing because people always wonder what those sorts of people are like, as I said, once the cameras are off. And I used to work the girls out and the guys, you know, pretty much daily, anytime there was a swimming pool or go down the beach, we'd be doing their workouts. And you know, I've got Anna and Frida in their bikinis doing workouts. As I used to say to my friends, this is a tough job, but somebody's got to do it.
Oh, what a memory. I'm glad that, you know, listening to that story, that there was something. I mean, I'm not trying to be as kissy or anything, but there was something clearly that they felt that they could trust you, like based on the work you provided and based on the character you put forth yourself, not only being a professional, but being a person in their environment. Like it's, you know, good should like generate ripples sometimes, you know, a good nature, kindness should. But at the same time, as you said, the entertainment industry have tons of stories of people being, you know, effed over after they fought. There was trust there, and then you have gossip, and then you have these tell-all books. But I'm very happy to hear that that was a very positive experience, and that big artists that you wouldn't blame for being guarded, you know, actually let down their guard.
Absolutely, and one of the, I think also when I look back, one of the reasons Bob and I got, you know, because I mostly worked with Bob until I went to the States, and then kept on working with Stevie Nicks and Linda, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the reasons was I just didn't look like a bodyguard, you know. We always used to dress pretty much like the band, so we would blend in, because the difference with, say, a business magnate or something is that a lot of the bands like the idea of they're not appearing to be any security. I mean, you were there. I used to say we're almost like the Alsatian dog, you know, you're just at your master's side and you're all nice and everything. You wag your tail until somebody gets a bit close, and then it's like, you know, you sort of arc up, and that's what you were there for. But the more, you know, we used to say that the best security is when you don't know you need it and you don't even know you have it. You know, our job was more as of a deterrent to sort of get to situations, deal with situations before they actually, you know, turned into something ugly. And the fact that I just look like a member of the band, whether out eating with them or traveling with them, was very, you know, diffusing. It was kind of disarming, I think, in a lot of ways, rather than having a big guy with his arms folded and more or less prompting that average drunk in the bar to say, oh, look at this big prick, you know, I'm going to see how I go with him. You know, it was just a different feel, and that I think helped a lot, you know. I think of it now, my years on the road, it was 25 plus years doing that, and it almost feels like another lifetime to me now. But I'm so thankful for having been exposed to that world. Mm-hmm. Because we, you know, you're talking about stories, you know, I've had so many people want me to write a book, and I said, no, I wouldn't. But the one book I am in the middle of, I say in the middle of because it's years in the making, I'm hopeless at getting these things finished. But I decided, well, if I was going to write a book, it would be about lessons I learned from being around people at top of their game. Meaning, you know, you don't get more longevity and more experience than someone like a Mick Jagger or a James Taylor that's still going some 30 years later, or Linda, or a David Bowie. I worked with David for 6 years. These people are the absolute top of the game, and I was very interested in the personality traits and kind of the actions and everything and the daily activities that would lend itself to that sort of longevity in such a fragile kind of area as rock and roll and singing and everything else. I mean, you're only as good as your last hit. And anyway, so the book is, for me, is really just being with these people in private moments. And again, lessons, it could be a Chuck Norris or a Jackie Chan. That's really what I'm working on. And I mean, we probably don't have time, but I could give you a couple of examples of that. And it's just, I try then to take those lessons and relate them to my martial arts and to my own personal life. And the whole idea of the book is that anybody should be able to read a chapter and apply that lesson to their own life. Not just it. I didn't want it to be about Richard Norton on the road, because who gives a shit? You know, I wanted it to be sort of more, there's a lesson there. There's a life lesson from these people talking about the greatness of the people I was around. And again, what gave them longevity and kept them being as good as they were, if that makes sense.
Oh, of course. I mean, that's an angle that can be relatable. Like, you're not, as you said, writing a story of those times, but you know, turning that to an angle that someone in an unrelated field and in an unrelated life with different goals can apply to their professional life and what have you. So I think that is a good angle to come at it from, rather than a biography of what it was, which I'm sure would be a good read, but I like that you thought it through in a different manner, maybe a more difficult manner. And but you know, thankfully, such lessons are immortal. So there is no deadline as such, that like 2015 is not a wrong year for, you know, lessons like that, if you will, or 2016 or whatever, whenever the book might come out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I, like, you know, even when I look at, you know, I just recently did an article on Chuck, and I love, as I said, I love just certain stories that come out. Like, for instance, you know, I asked Chuck how his movie career started, and again, I'm paraphrasing, but it came out of, you know, Steve McQueen used to be a personal student, a private student of Chuck Norris's.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at dinner that basically Steve says to Chuck, well, Chuck, you know, you're closing your schools down now. You're not competing anymore. What are you going to do with your life? And Chuck said, well, what do you mean? What am I going to do? And he says, well, that's all over. You know, being on the stage as far as a martial artist has sort of had its time. What do you think about looking at acting? And Chuck said, he laughed. He said, oh, Steve, he said, I couldn't do that. You know, blah, 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 all the reasons why not. And Steve looks at him, starts laughing. He says, wait a minute, for the last 2 years, all you've done is tell us as students that believe in yourself, have, you know, trust in your destiny, your own abilities and everything else, that anything is possible. And he says, now you're telling me you can't do this? And Chuck said he had to laugh. And he said, well, he laughed at Steve. And he said, well, I didn't say I couldn't do it. I just said I wasn't sure. And it basically kicked Chuck in the butt, and I'm paraphrasing, wasn't in those words, to go, well, of course. I mean, here I am with all these sort of spiritualistic and inspirational words every time I teach a class, and now I'm basically saying I can't do something, you know, well, where's the follow through on that? And the rest is history. I mean, that was the impetus to give Chuck the thought that, yes, I why not? I'm a karate champion, you know, I got to the top of the field that I'm in as in, you know, as a karate fighter, you know, now let me try another field. And that started him off. And I think, you know, that to me illustrates, and I do this exactly the same thing. I'll get offered a job and immediately I realize the easiest thing in the world is for me to say, oh, no, I can't do it because I'm busy or because of this, because of that. When a lot of times it's just fear of being up to scratch, of being good enough to do that job, to be judged by your peers and not look silly and everything, and to be what you think you need to be in order to complete that particular task. And that's why I bring up things like Chuck with that. You know, everyone thinks that people just like a Chuck Norris would take on acting with no fear, with no reservations. No, it'll be easy, but it's never that way. And, I'll give you another example too, which is totally abstract, of being out with Mick and Keith Richards and all of them at a sort of at a club, you know, in a hotel in Australia. And again, I hear, was it Charlie Watts? It might have been Keith saying, oh, go on, ask her to dance, go on. They were like two kids, you know, they're going to a discotheque and everything, and they're basically scared to go and ask this girl to dance. And I realized that the reason they were is because someone like Mick didn't want to actually go over, be exposed to the public eye, ask somebody to dance or do something with them and have the girl say no. That the ego wouldn't be able to handle that.
Right.
You know? And again, it's just examples of just individual fears we all have, and no matter where we are at with life. And look, the book is going to be full of examples and everything that just make people look at themselves and their natural fears and everything, but just decide to sort of look at seriously and go, you know what, what's the worst that can happen if I give this a good shot and I give it a good try?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the point of it for me. You know, I used to look at Lindsey Buckingham with Fleetwood Mac. There wasn't a minute in that tour bus when we're traveling all over the States where he's not trying to find a new note on that guitar, strumming away. In other words, their excellence didn't come by accident. You know, it came from passion and it came from just living what they were doing. And, you know, as you would know, we're the same as martial artists. It's not a part-time thing. We have to live it. It's not the 2 hours on the mat that's important. It's the other 22 hours of the day that's important. What you do your life. Are you a martial artist 24 hours a day? And Again, Lindsey Buckingham, you realize he's a musician 24 hours a day. That's why he's as good as he is and why he had the longevity in his career. And again, I won't go on about it, but they're the sort of examples that I wanted to give in the book, using people I work with as examples of that excellence and that continually striving to be the absolute best they could be.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I sincerely hope you get it done, but in your own time and on your own terms and all of that. So I really hope to see that. But let's move on to the acting side of things. I mean, is that something you pursued? I mean, focusing specifically on Chuck Norris and the Octagon. I mean, how does the Octagon happen? Is it more of a you fell into it, or was it some part of you that wanted to pursue acting and stunts?
No, it is absolutely something I fell into. Look, Bob Jones and I, you know, we had a style called Zendokai, which still is around today. We started that in the 1970s. And we had schools. We had at one stage over 500 schools throughout Australia. And we brought Chuck had gone over to America, you know, on a little trip to train with people like Joe Lewis. And of course, he met Chuck. And Bob decided to bring Chuck out to Australia. I think it was in 1978. And we had some tournaments. Bob was one of the first to introduce kickboxing into Australia. And we brought Chuck out to do some demonstrations at these tournaments. I was also doing demonstration with some Okinawan weapons like sai and the bow, you know, as in the staff. And anyway, Chuck and I met, and we immediately hit it off, you know, as friends. I mean, you cannot meet a nicer person than Chuck Norris. I mean that sincerely. And we just got on so well. When Chuck eventually left the country, he said, "Look, Rich, if you ever get to California, give me a call, and we'll do some training." And for a kid living in Australia, which, you know, was, you know, on the other ends of the earth to everything else, I thought, wow, what an opportunity. As it turned out, a year later, Linda Ronstadt, the young ones wouldn't even know Linda, but Linda was, of course, was huge rock and roll star in her day and country and western singer and everything else. Anyway, she wanted me to come and work for her full-time in California. So with a lot of umming and ahhing off, I went, and one of the first people I called was Chuck. And I went around and started training at Chuck's house. I had a gym in the back of his house, and we worked out every morning. And it was then that he was in the early stages of the Octagon. They were in pre-production, pre-pre. Mm-hmm. And because Chuck had seen me demonstrating using weapons, he asked me to be his main nemesis in the movie and also help choreograph a lot of the fights, which I ended up doing with Chuck's brother, Aaron. We rehearsed all those fights in Chuck's backyard. There's some old black and white footage I still have of those rehearsals. And I ended up playing Keo. That's Keo, you know, the masked ninja with the crimson sort of head thing on. The reason that happened is because technically Keo was supposed to be Asian, so right. They blacked my eyes out and put them, be politically incorrect these days, wouldn't it, Ken?
But anyway. I guess so, yeah. But no one really notices that super clearly. I mean, you're wearing black as well, so I mean, yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah, no, well again, Chuck wanted me to play Keo, who was really the main bad guy, along with Tadashi, you know, Yamashita. And I helped put the fights together. I also was one of four ninja. Four of us did all the ninja work in Octagon. So I used to say to people, you ever see somebody go splat in Octagon, it's probably me falling off a wall or doing something. But that was the start of my movie career. And as Keo, it was a phenomenal experience because, once again, it introduced me to the world of film. Because my immediate reaction was, wow, how good is this? I'm on a movie set. I'm getting paid. I'm with one of my idols, as in Chuck Norris, but I'm also around people like Tadashi Yamashita and the Ree brothers, Simon and Philip Ree. I was just around some phenomenal martial artists, swapping stories and techniques with them. I thought, gee, what a great way to make a living. So that was it for me. You know, I was still doing bodyguard work at the time, but I did a couple more movies with Chuck, and then I went and auditioned for a film with Freddie Weintraub. Fred Weintraub, of course, produced Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee and Bob Klaus. I auditioned for them for a film called Force 5. I remember there's at least 100 of us, 100 of the best martial artists in America. I also remember thinking, oh God, what am I doing? I mean, I'm an Aussie with a funny accent, you know, how am I going to do this? And it ended up getting down to 10 people, and I was still one of the 10. Now, considering that was also a big change for me in attitude, where instead of thinking, why me, I started to think, why not me? I've trained just as hard as anybody. I've got just as good a shot of doing this. And so I ended up getting one of the leads in Force 5, you know, alongside Joe Lewis and Bong Suhan and Benny the Jet Okidas. And that off I went. And that led to a career of doing what we would loosely call B-grade movies. You know, I used to go to the Philippines and Thailand and all over the place, having a ball doing these action movies through the 80s and 90s. And so it really happened by accident. It was really through Chuck again, just asking me if I was interested in doing this and taking the, you know, the bit between the teeth and just going for it.
How did the move to Hong Kong happen? It's, I mean, you said you worked all over the place, but was Hong Kong something that had a, the cinema, that is, the industry, well, was that something that had a reputation that reached you? So you have, did you have a personal desire to try and work with profiles you've heard of out of Hong Kong?
No, I didn't. Look, I, you know, like everybody used to have Kung Fu Theater and everything on television, even in Australia. But I was never really that taken with that, the idea of Hong Kong cinema. And it came through a gentleman named Pat Johnson, who was the fight coordinator on Force 5 and used to be a partner of Chuck Norris's in martial arts schools. Mm-hmm. Pat was also the choreographer on the very first Karate Kid.
Right.
And Pat had done Rumble in the Bronx, with Jackie Chan, one of his first American films. And Pat said, oh, I'm going to recommend to Jackie Chan that he use you, as in me, because we trained together. So I was in Japan, of all places, on tour with James Taylor, or one of them, Linda, whoever, it doesn't matter. And I was in some little place in Fukuoka, which is outside of Osaka in Japan, and I get a phone call. His voice says, oh, hey, Richard, I work for Jackie Chan. She says, Jackie wants you to come and work with him in a movie. What's your price? I said, well, hold on a second. What is this? No, he wants you to come work. What's your price? I said, well, when do you want me to come? And I said, well, he needs you here in 3 days.
Wow.
I said, well, the price doesn't really matter. I can't do it. I'm obligated to finish. I was working, you know, again, doing personal bodyguard work. I still had another 2 months of the tour. So I had to say no. As it turned out, I got contacted again at a later date. And this was for the film Twinkle, Twinkle, Lucky Stars. Once again, Jackie was interested in having me come out and work with him, which this time I did. And I ended up, and that again was through Pat Johnson recommending me. So off I went to Hong Kong. Boy, what an eye-opener that was, I must tell you. I'm thinking, you know, this is in 1984 or something like that. And I head off to Hong Kong and I'm thinking, oh, yeah, this will be fun. I'll be able to do some of my stuff and display some of my goju and everything. Well, and I'm thinking probably 10-hour days. Well, the biggest eye-opener about that, as you know, was we would do the dialogue and everything. That was pretty easy. I did nothing for maybe 3 or 4 weeks sitting in Hong Kong. Then the fight stuff started. My first fight was with Sammo Hung, and I was literally on the set 18 hours a day, 7 days a week for 3.5 weeks.
Wow.
Doing that one fight. They did not give a damn about what I did. It was all about what they would choreograph and they would want you to do, and you would rehearse on camera. I was never sort of working out beforehand, and you do 30, 40, 50 takes if it took it on camera to get the fight right.
Wow.
It was the most grueling thing I'd ever gone through. In fact, I remember getting back to my hotel room after the first 3 days of fight stuff with Sammo, and I said out loud, if I can get through this, I can get through anything. I mean, the contact was almost full on in the body as well as some facial contact. That's just the way they did it then.
Certainly Sammo's way, because that's, you know, I'm a great fan of both, of Jackie's and Sammo, if we focus on those two. But I'm a great fan of, in sort of a maybe sadistic way as a viewer, that Sammo's action was always harder and powerful and felt more violent. And it's because it was, for real, almost.
Basically, what you saw happen really happened. I mean, they if you were to sidekick somebody, they wanted you to sink that sidekick almost as hard as you could. And by the way, I was fine with that in that I, especially back then, I was younger and I wouldn't do it now necessarily, but I was always in really good shape and I felt I was quite tough physically. So I would take all the bumps and all the hits they'd put out. And the only thing I remember saying to Samo, as long as you let me hit you back just as hard. But the thing about Samo was he wants you to hit him just as hard as he hit you. He's still, Samo to me is still the most creative action director I've ever worked with. And that guy could put a fight together with anything in a room. So diverse. And I'm, again, just such an incredible fan of Samo's. We got on really well. When he saw that I would take all the knocks and hits and everything like that, we became very good friends. He'd take me to look at dailies, even though we only got 2 hours off a day to do that. Took me shopping, and Jackie took me shopping around for cameras in Hong Kong. So I had a very good relationship early on, which, by the way, was a blessing because I hate to say it, but if you're an outsider like a Guaylo, you know, the foreigner, whether it's British or European on a Hong Kong movie set, if you weren't in that inner circle, man, you got treated like shit.
I've heard those stories, yeah, and I mean, I've never experienced them, of course, but that you hear enough of them in volume where you kind of think to yourself that it's not too far removed from the truth that there is a divide, there can be a divide there, and a pretty dark one, so to say.
Yeah, they would just scream, you stupid, you got no timing, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it's, it was quite a trip. But luckily for me, because I established a good friendship and Samo and Jackie liked me from the beginning, that put me in the inner circle. So I was kind of okay, you know, but I just saw a lot of them. I thought, wow, that's brutal. But, and it's tough. I mean, to be a Hong Kong stuntman, oh my goodness, you know.
Oh, boy.
Hey, as you mentioned, Samo was certainly didn't go lightly on his stunt people, because to be part of Samo Hung or Jackie Chan's stunt team, the best way to describe that, it'd be like being a guitarist and getting offered a job with the Rolling Stones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the future benefit of that credit is just priceless. So all the stunties wanted to be a part of that stunt team, and they would do whatever it took, and that included getting the crap beaten out of you and all the rest of it. I don't know how it is now. It's been a long time since I've been in Hong Kong, but it was full on. Mind you, you know, I said I got back to my room and I'm saying, oh, man, if I can get through this, I can get through anything. Well, I'm just doing one movie. Jackie and people like Sam and that were often doing two movies at once, and they would do that throughout the whole year, year in, year out.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I always felt like a little baby when I looked at it from that point of view, because their work ethic was just unbelievable and their level of excellence. I used to sit on the monitor with Samo and take 30 and, okay, one more. And I'd be kidding, what the hell is he looking for? And ironically, he'd eventually say, okay, we got it. And there would be just something in the take. But They were about excellence in their action and in their fight scenes. You know, that's probably the biggest difference between a Western, the way we would shoot it in a Western movie in Hong Kong. Jackie always said to me, you realize it's not about the drama and the talking heads. His audience wanted to see the action. And it didn't matter whether the fight scene went for half an hour. It was about the ballet. And, you know, Jackie used to have, he had every silent movie known then with Laurel and Hardy and, you know, Charles Chaplin. And he used to look at all those silent stunts and copy that. And he always said to me he wanted that you could turn the sound off in everything in his movies and still enjoy the physicality of the movie and almost the comedy of the action.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one reviewer said about Jackie, which I thought really hit it on the head, he said, looking at Jackie doing a fight scene is like watching a speeding bullet in reverse.
Yes.
So it's a bit like Charlie Chaplin trying to get away from the threat and creating sort of havoc and mayhem at the same time. And I think that was pretty much it. But I just learned so much being around. They were the absolute maestros of the action, you know, movie world. And to be on the set for so many years, it was just amazing. At one stage, I was the only, like, Guaylo to ever get invited back for one, you know, more than one movie with Jack. I think Benny Yokidis was the other one, Benny the Jet. But
yeah, so, I did too. Yeah,
yeah. So it was a thrill for me.
for any of those movies, were you ever aware of any fighting conceptually beforehand, or it was all coming to set and hearing of the ideas on the spot? Or I mean, when you reached City Hunter, was there any pre-planning you knew of, or it was just show up and see what's going on?
Well, if there was, I wasn't made aware of it, meaning, you know, that was the thing, you know, back then all the scripts were either in Mandarin or Cantonese.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time they were writing the script each day as they went. So even if it was, you wouldn't know. So it literally was about turning up. I remember doing City Hunter and being in makeup, and Wong Jing, you know, the director, be lying on his little, almost like a pool lounge, you know, in the dressing room, be gigging away because he was just writing that day's script. And then he would often just give it to one of the second or third ADs. And so many times they would actually direct the scene. It was a very, very strange method. But it was, you didn't know. I mean, they would literally have you rehearse on camera, you know. And again, they weren't really interested in changing anything to suit your style or whatever, which in my mind would have made it a little easier.
Yeah.
They just, no, one more, one more. They just figured if you did it long enough, you'd eventually get it. So the end to all of that is that it certainly, everyone says, ah, it must have been so much fun working with Jackie. Well, no, fun is the furthest it was, you know, because it was such hard work.
Yeah.
Just sitting around waiting. They keep you on set because they never knew what they're going to shoot left. So even the lighting guys couldn't pre-light because they're waiting to find out what the next scene is going to be. And then you do it and it would take as long as it took. And it's like City Hunter fight scene took 6.5 weeks to film that.
Really? Wow.
That I did with Jackie. So that gives you an idea. And look, Hong Kong back then, there was no unions or overtime, so they could shoot till they're blue in the face, you know.
Were you ever injured during your Hong Kong stint, considering the pain involved?
I did a ligament or two, but I've been pretty lucky, you know, touch wood, as far as injuries on movie sets. You know, I've my nose broken when I was shooting Mr. Nice Guy, but all in all, Judy was my wife in the background feeding information. See, because I'm too old now, I forget all this stuff. No. but when I was shooting Magic Crystal with Cynthia, we'd been shooting 16 hours a day, and you know, she had a wooden sword, and I think I'm ducking, and she thinks she's hitting the right place, and I got smacked in the eye, and it just missed my eye by a millimeter, and they took me to hospital, put 8 stitches in my eye. They didn't give me any anesthetic because they didn't want my eye to swell off. And I'm back set within an hour just filming again. I mean, that was just the way it was, you know.
Were you part of the Greece shoot, or you were only in Hong Kong for that one? Because they shot in Greece for Magic Crystal.
Yeah, no, we went to both places, which was great. Funny story, I remember when this accident happened, they said, okay, we pick you up at 6 a.m. I said, no. I said, well, what do you mean? The producer said, well, you know, this is why these accidents happen, because we're shooting 16 hours straight. We're in some little underground set, you know, sweating. That costume you see me wearing in Magic Crystal was the only costume.
Of course.
And after every take, they would have an iron and an ironing board, and they'd iron it dry. That's a bit icky for you, a little bit of too much information. But, you know, but that was the way it was. And then they said, well, we pick up 6. I said, no. You know, I said, we agreed that it would be X amount of hours. Anyway, it turned out that I only really had, I don't know, a week shooting. So I made a nice little deal with the producers. I'll come in the morning, but I need you to fly my wife out from Australia to Hong Kong, then to Greece, and put us up for the 5 or 6 weeks that you're all going to be there. And they ended up agreeing to that. And that was fantastic, because I didn't have a lot of shooting in Greece, but we rented a little motor scooter and ended up driving all over Athens on this motor scooter. See, so there is an upside.
Indeed. And that movie, just to geek out a little bit, that movie was choreographed by one of my favorite Hong Kong choreographers outside of Jackie and Sammo, and Tony Leung, Leung Siu Hong. And he's so underrated in terms of the intricacy of action and even the power of action. And he's an excellent director. He went on to direct a couple of movies with Keith Vitale and things like that. So, and you also got to work with the likes of Andy Lau, who's still around to this day and still this hard-working actor, an ageless actor. I mean, if you saw Andy Lau in a still from Magic Crystal versus today, not a whole lot of difference. So.
He was great. You know, I love that. And you're right, the choreography in that I was so happy with, because, you know, for someone like me going on the set, you don't really get to see a lot of it. You're just doing take after take. And it's kind of only when you're like anybody else, you get to sit and watch a screening that you get to appreciate that sort of work. And I was, the thing that thrilled me about Magic Crystal is they had no idea I could use weapons, but I used to love playing around with Psy. You know, mm-hmm. on weapon, and they, I started playing around with one, and oh, great, and that's how that got incorporated into that whole fight, because they felt it unusual that someone like me could use that sort of a weapon, and that made it very personal for me, because Psy was one of my first and most sort of loved martial art weapons, so to be actually using in a fight scene in a Hong Kong movie like that was a particular thrill for me.
It shows up on screen too. These spur-of-the-moment ideas, they are well conveyed on screen when all is said and done. I think, I don't know if you've seen the full Magic Crystal recently or in years or whatever, but it must be weird to walk onto that movie and onto that set, that, because presumably that underground set, at some point you might have seen the creepy alien puppet, and you might wonder to yourself, is this an action movie? What's going on here? Because
Yeah.
But it's a wonderful, like, free-for-all Hong Kong movie, and they don't do these movies anymore, I can guarantee you that, Richard. It's a one, you can't be sci-fi and this kind of action in one, you have to settle on one.
Yeah, because, I mean, even now, you'd have to admit, you look at the alien and you're like, oh my god, what the hell is that, you know, but... Look, it was always off the wall because, as I said again, it was about the fights and the action. Everything else is almost incidental. Yeah. I mean, it's changed. Even American movies, it's very much changed. You know, when I did a lot of those movies in the 80s, as long as you had, say, six fight scenes, you could sell that movie anywhere. Mm-hmm. Well, it's changed now. Everything now needs to be character-driven, you know, and not just action for the sake of action. You know, there needs to be so much drama within the action. It needs to be justified. It's just a different world.
Sounds like a slower way of working. And of course, every era is different. But, you know, it's good that you had a more free-for-all era to at least look back on, to have had that experience. And because you can't bring back certain eras either, and certain thinking as the time moved forward and all of that. And I'm curious, by the way, just on a minor side, not on Wong Jing again, knowing very little of what goes on a Hong Kong movie set, because I'm only a fan, is at least working with Wong Jing akin to this. This is my theory and what I've heard. Is he ever on set when action is involved, or is the set therefore run by the action director during the action parts, or does Wong Jing want to have any input on how action is conveyed?
No, what you said is correct. Wong Jing, you know, with all the movies virtually I did then, except for a Jackie movie, there would always be a dramatic director and there would be an action director. Mm. So it's, you know, with City Hunter, no, the action was always turned over to Jackie. Wong Jing would direct the, you know, because his main claim to fame was comedy, you know.
Of course, yeah.
And so he would handle all that, write all of that. But then there would be a number of action directors, so to speak, that would handle different aspects of the action, you know, along with Jackie. Now, it's a very separate thing. And by the way, you know, having done so many Western movies, I just think it's such a good way to do it, because mm-hmm. the amount of films, and you'd be aware that I've done, where a director's very good technically, they understand how to frame a shot and everything, and they're very good with drama, but they don't know action. And I think to not turn it over to a really skilled action coordinator, stunt coordinator, is just ludicrous. I think it makes perfect sense. Of course, they need to be in sync, you know, and it needs to have the same through line. But it just made perfect sense to me that they would do that in Hong Kong the way they did it.
There's footage floating around of the different fight footage from Jackie's The Protector. One was more supervised by James Clickenhouse and one was more supervised by Jackie. It's the same fight scene conceptually and all of that, and you can see the difference being the, for me anyway personally, the excitement is seeing the flow and rhythm that Jackie shot, and compared to James Glickenhouse's more supervised footage, it's a bit more stiff, and not the rhythm isn't on as such. So that's a superb example of how it is indeed a good idea to let the Hong Kong action director do his or her job.
Yeah, I remember I saw Jackie in, he invited my wife and I to a Chinese New Year celebration in LA when he was shooting Rush Hour. Mm-hmm. And I went there and I went up and I see Jackie and I said, oh, how's everything? Oh, fucking American movie, never do another one. And I said, oh, he said, why, what's wrong? He said, oh, you know what I like to change, you know, he's very in the moment, you know, he'll change something on the spot. And he said, I say, okay, I want to change this. And he said, then six people have heart attacks, you know, the director, writer, the producer. So he says, oh, okay, just do it. And but at the same token, he also realized that he had to allow himself to be directed because it's a different audience, you know. I mean, he realized that the type of movie that would work in a lot of Europe and of course Hong Kong and Asia and China was a very different sort of movie to what would work in America, a la the Rumble and Rush Hour type movies, you know. It was a different audience, and he had to come to terms with that and compromise on the amount of time and effort put into the action and allow an American director to sort of make an American movie as opposed to like a Hong Kong movie. Look, even in the beginning, I remember Sammo Hung asking me, he said, you know, Richard, he says, why don't my movies work in America? You know, this is way before, you know, the Hong Kong style of action really took off in the US. He said, why don't my movies work? And I said, Sammo, where do you want me to start? I said, you don't have a script. Your stories are unrealistic. Your fights go for half an hour. You've got a guy jumping off a mini tramp doing eight kicks. I said, as soon as a Western audience sees that and it's no longer believable, they just buy out of it. They go, oh, that's bullshit. You couldn't do that. Whereas the Hong Kong audience appreciate, as I always say, the acrobatic ability in the ballet of the fights, you know, whatever the props are, whether it's wires or tramps. So it was a big difference, you know, and it took a while for that style of shooting of a lot of camera moves, you know, continually changing the direction of the camera. It took a while for that to sort of take play or to really hit in America. And ironically, I think the reason it did is people get bored, you know. I mean, you can have two people at best. You can have Bruce Lee, you know, with a guy in the middle of a football field. If you just shoot it as a wide, it'll probably be quite boring. You know, it gets down to how you shoot it, your editing, your camera angles, your inserts that makes a fight exciting or not, just because kids now, they've been exposed to every computer game, you know, visual effects, graphics, special effects. It's very hard to entertain a young mind these days. So that gets down to more than just the choreography. That gets down to the style of shooting, you know, and and everything else that goes with it. But like you said, for me to be a part of that old school, as we would call it, was, you know, it was just fantastic. I mean, I wouldn't trade that for the world.
Is it a relief, therefore, to go back from working in Hong Kong for a movie or two, then to shoot a China O'Brien? Is there a relief physically working in the West, having done a few Hong Kong movies?
Well, you're better prepared. Like I said to you, when I said out loud, if I can get through this, I can get through anything. To do a Western movie on normal union hours is like a cakewalk for me. Because, you know, if people complain because you do a 14-hour day, I'm like, you don't even know.
Per se. So,
you know, after being a sweaty Hong Kong studio with no air conditioning, you know, when we shot Twinkle Twinkle Lucky Stars, I lost something like 15 pounds in weight in a matter of 2 weeks. It was that hot, and just sweating the whole time. So I've been through that. Now, and to answer your question, yes, it's easy doing a China O'Brien movie. Is a more, I would say, pleasant experience.
Sure.
The downside is that you will never get the fight that you would having been in a Hong Kong movie. Mm-hmm. That's the trade-off. Shooting, it's easier, whereas in Hong Kong, it's harder. But you also know that when you go and watch that City Hunter or Twinkle Twinkle Magic Crystals, you are probably going to be blown away with what they do with the action, as opposed to the predictability of what you'll get in a more Western kind of action film.
You know, you're a rare breed, the likes of you and Cynthia Rothrock, that you are immersed so well into the Hong Kong action style, because it's so vastly different. Like, like it comes down to me thinking that, yeah, I'm so impressed that you guys kept up from movie to movie. Like, it wasn't just we managed to do it on this shoot. Like, you went on to several movies. Cynthia went on to several movies and kept up splendidly, which is so impressive in an industry where, as we discussed, being accepted as a Westerner is hard on its own. But to be a featured player and a featured action player, I mean, Cynthia got a lead role in a Hong Kong movie as well. So it's very impressive to me that you guys, and several other examples, of course, managed to be immersed so well.
And thank you for that. But you know what? I've got to be honest and say it was not by design. It's not like you could back then specifically prepare yourself for a Hong Kong movie. It's kind of like it, you either worked or you didn't. Meaning, I remember the big thing with Jackie telling me, he said, I get so many Americans, they're tough. They want to show me how tough they are. First of all, even way back then, he was over the idea of people trying to hit him as hard as they could. But he said, it's all about timing. Mm-hmm. It's just timing. If you don't have the timing, he said, that works for his style of choreography, he didn't care how good a martial artist you were, it was never going to work for him. Now, I would be lying if I said, yeah, I specifically worked on my timing to make it work for a Jackie film. I mean, it just was what it was. And thank God I had the timing and the understanding, maybe in the intelligence, that I was able to fit in with his style of timing and fighting and choreography, because I don't see how you could prepare for that. Like nowadays they do, because it's in hindsight. I'm sort of getting off the track a little bit, but it's kind of relevant. I went to a screening a couple of weeks ago that a friend invited me to, and it was an action on film festival where it's a week of kind of, you know, people trying to put their action films out there for the public. And there's some stunties and some friends that train at 8711, which is a legendary, you know, stunt academy here in LA. And they had done a movie that spent $35,000. They got $10 from all different stunt people to put in to make this movie. Mm-hmm. But my point is, it's an hour and 10 long movie, and it's called Unlucky Stars. And the reason they rang me was they were paying homage to the old Hong Kong movies like Lucky Stars. And they'd even done a fight scene, that Sammo Hung in Twinkle Twinkle Lucky Stars. They more or less kind of created a version of that on screen. And they were thrilled to have me there. There's a little nice little gesture thanking people like myself and Cynthia for inspiring them. Mm-hmm. But the thing that struck me was the fights. Now, there's a guy called Vlad that did the choreography. And I said to Vlad, I said, how much rehearsal time did you get with these fights? And blah, blah. He said, no, we didn't get any rehearsal because there was no budget. I just put the ideas together. I would sort of send a text to the guys, it's a style of fight. Well, I'm telling you, I said, Vlad, I've got in this, Dennis Rule was the director. I said, these fights would stack up against anything I've ever seen. They were that good. Considering, you know, no budget, no rehearsal time, and it was very much in kind of the old style Hong Kong, like action genre style. That was the idea of the film, was a bit of comedy. But I was blown away, and it just struck me that where action has come since I was doing it. I mean, you couldn't do the sort of action I did in the 80s wouldn't stack up today. I mean, it just wouldn't, you know, but we did what you had to do then. You know what I mean? Everything changes. You know, it's like martial arts. Now it's an MMA world. Well, it's a very different world. It's the same with fighting. And I was just struck by the brilliance of the performers in these fights that Dennis and Vlad and them have put together for this film. If you ever get a chance, I mean, they're getting it out there. They've got some sort of distribution. It's called Unlucky Stars. Dennis Rule is the name of the director. And it's just well worth seeing, realizing what they did with nothing. It just inspired me to think, wow. And they want to do another one and they want me to play a bigger role. And I said, absolutely. Because I said, I really believe in giving back. And I said, you guys, you're carrying the mantle now. You know, you guys are carrying on what we sort of started, and I couldn't be more impressed with the passion and the quality of work that these kids are doing. So
definitely, we'll see if we can find some links for that, some clips from the project at hand. So that was my heart, that a passion and sincerity still exists for that kind of action and understanding of it too. It's not this retro throwback, but an understanding and a passion and sincerity for it. That sounds very good. To cap off the Hong Kong career, which is kind of odd because the Hong Kong career, so to say, ended. I use ended loosely. It's not the end of your career. Ended on home ground. So how fun was it to work on home ground in Australia for Mr. Nice Guy?
Look, Ken, I can't tell you how thrilled I was that Sammo wanted to cast me as the lead bad guy in Mr. Nice Guy.
Yeah.
First of all, because it had been a while since I'd worked with Sammo, and, you know, because I've already said I had such an incredible respect for Sammo, I was just thrilled to, at a much later stage of my career, be working again with Sammo. And, of course, secondly, to be shooting in my hometown of Melbourne. I thought it doesn't
get... Oh, it was in Melbourne as well. That's right.
Yeah, wow. Melbourne and Hunter Valley, which is outside of Sydney in New South Wales. And so all of that was just amazing. I mean, look, the only downside for me was, you know, they went something like 3 months over, as they normally do. And basically, producers just decided, that's it. You know, we're finishing this week. There should have been a big fight scene at the very end with myself and Jackie, because I did say to Sammo, I said, what's the point of using me if you're not going to have a big fight? And it was just a matter of time. But it was fantastic. To be in Australia and to be working with Sammo again, you know, like that was just fantastic. The only funny part was my suit. When I saw my suit, I remember going up to Jackie and I said, oh, no, that's right. Jackie walked up to me and you remember that? I didn't know if you remember the striped suit. And he says, oh, fucking horrible suit. I said, for God's sake, you're the fucking producer. Say something, you know? Just laughed. And then, of course, the slick back hair and the cigar. I said to Sammo, why can't I just be a normal looking bad guy? Why do you have to make me look like a fucking idiot with his hair slicked back and the cigar? No. This is good. This would be good for the character. And look, you get reminded that if you're going to do a movie like that with someone, Jackie, you just have to completely abandon any preconceptions and just got to jump in for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
Because the very first lines I gave, I like to underplay things, you know, and Sammo, no, I need it like this. And you just realize you almost need to be a caricature in that sort of a movie for it to work, or it just doesn't work, you know.
I mean, it's all about good fun. I mean, that movie is good fun. I saw it for the first time on my one and only trip to the United States. I saw it at the cinema with a big audience, that they were all having a ball. I could barely hear any dialogue because everyone was laughing so much and having a good time. And I rewatched it recently, and it's still a good, fun movie. It has the Hong Kong stamp on it. It's not this international production where the international side took over and decided to shoot the action their way or anything. It's so much fun to see Sammo and Jackie and all the crew involved doing their thing on their terms, seemingly, even though they didn't get to shoot the final fight, as you said. But Hong Kong movies that change locale and go abroad always is super appealing to me, whether it's New York or, in this case, Australia and Melbourne. So it always adds a flavor to Hong Kong style when they control it and it's somewhere else but Hong Kong for once.
Yeah, but like, and you hit on the head again. It's about jumping on board and just having fun. You just know it's just a fun ride. It's not to be taken like this unbelievably dramatically serious movie. And once you are okay with that and you're able to let go, then it is what it is, and you know, you just have a ball with it.
Is that a rare occurrence to work in Australia for you nowadays?
Yes, only because of living here most of the time, though there's a lot of productions going to Australia now. I mean, I produced a little movie called Under the Gun that we shot in Melbourne. It's a very small budget, you know, a little playing around with action. But other than that, most of the work is sourced out of here, out of the US. At least it was. As I said, it's changed. They've done Pirates of the Caribbean. They're going to shoot the next Thor movie in Australia, and there's quite a number of big productions heading that way. Mind you, a lot of the reason for that is our dollar is very weak at the moment. It's about 72 cents to the American dollar, and there's good rebates. So, you know, that's some of the reason.
And I've always wondered, I simply don't know, and I kind of thought of it while doing the research for this interview. As many people know, you worked both in front of and behind the camera on Mad Max Fury Road, and it's a big gig, obviously, fight coordinator or stunt coordinator. I mean, how does one get a gig like that? I mean, is it all that you have worked up this experience and people come to you, or do you have to sort of pursue work like a Mad Max and even Suicide Squad, which you did in Canada?
You know what? It's both, Ken. It's a people business, you know. It's a bit like what I said with the bodyguard work. You don't get a bodyguard job through sending in a resume and a headshot. Mm-hmm. It's usually through somebody recommending you, somebody you've worked with, an actor, whatever. It's a very, very clicky business, this business of second unit directing, stunt coordinating, fight coordinating, because it's such a lucrative business. I mean, if you get in that inner circle, it's amazingly lucrative. So the ones that are already in there don't want to let anyone else in for obvious reason, no matter how good you are. In fact, the better you are, the more of a threat you are. Mm-hmm. But so my work in Mad Max came from Guy Norris. Guy Norris was the supervising stunt coordinator and second unit director on Mad Max. He's worked with George Miller for, you know, 20, 30 years. And I've worked with Guy for the very first time in a film called Blood of Heroes, or something, with Rutger Hauer and Joan Chen. That's when I met Guy, and I was an actor in that. And, you know, we became good friends. He's well aware of my action abilities. So it was Guy that hired me on Mad Max as the fight coordinator, which, again, you talk about thrills to be part of such an iconic Aussie franchise as Mad Max. Yeah. You know, I thought, look, what a swan song, even if it was the last one I ever did. What a great one to go out on. So I worked on that, phenomenal experience. And the same thing happened with Suicide Squad because of Mad Max Guy and the attention it got. You know, it's funny we talk about old school, but Mad Max, this latest one, has really put the action film on its head, in that the idea that Mad Max was old school, that every stunt, every motorcycle crash, every car crash, every roll, every tanker crash was a real stunt person in a real vehicle. Sure, you have visual effects in there creating certain structures and buildings, but every stunt was real. The danger was there, and I think the organicness of that really, really resonated with Mad Max. And as a result, Guy got hired on Suicide Squad, you know, and Guy hired me, you know, as the fight coordinator. And that's the way it works. Usually, you know, coordinators will have a team. If it works, you know, if it doesn't work, you don't last. But, you know, they like to have a team that, you know, well, I know Guy, so I know how he works. I know what he likes. It doesn't work. I know his methodology. So that's also helpful to him as well as to me. Mm. And that's kind of the way it works, you know. But having said that, already out of that, there's other opportunities opening up for me, because to have two large credits like Mad Max and Suicide Squad in 2 years is great for my career, because, you know, I'm 65 years of age now. You never know whether this is the end of it or not. And suddenly you get a couple of gigs like that, and it's like, wow, okay, off we go again, you know. And that's very exciting. I was also smart enough to realize a long time ago that as an actor, you're just a product. How you look, your age, and everything determines what roles you get. And I realized that I need to be au fait with what it's about working behind the camera. And I was in Lithuania for 4 years, did second unit directing and stunt coordinating on a series for 4 years. And that was an unbelievable learning experience for me, you know, with what it taught me. And it held me in good stead today to be able to do the coordinating that I'm doing. And I think what I bring to the table with a film like this is understanding the actor's process in a fight. Because in the old days, you know, you could have, as I said, you have six fights, and you'd have drama, drama, drama. The drama stops, then you have a fight, and then the drama continues. Well, now a film, an action film, the action has to be almost incidental to the film being good. You should be able to take all the action out and still have great characters and a great story. And Suicide Squad is very much, David Ayer is very much about character. He wrote Suicide Squad. For those who don't know, David directed Fury with Brad Pitt, the tank movie, and End of Watch, phenomenal movies. And
oh, that was a great one. Yeah, I loved End of Watch.
So the exciting thing for me with Suicide Squad is it's about character and it's about story. Yes, there's action in it, but it's not an action movie per se. And that to me is exciting because I've got to tell you, I've watched some of these blockbuster movies out lately and they just leave me cold because how many times do I want to see the Golden Gate Bridge, disintegrate with visual effects? I'm sick of it.
Exactly. I mean, that's why I'm not necessarily cynical, but I've fallen out of favor with the big spectacle movie, the big special effects movie, which was why watching the likes of Mad Max Fury Road, it brought me back to that cool place because it was physical. It was physical again, and this, I don't know how it was allowed to be this physical because it looks effing dangerous, but obviously Control being a big budgeted production, but you guys pulled it off, man, and I don't know if such a movie can be made again, if they can recapture that.
No, it's funny you say that because, everyone's, oh, are we going to make another one? Well, you can imagine George relishes the idea because of the success. I mean, this was such a good movie for Warner Brothers because it's an R movie and it's an action movie. And for it to get such almost like art house critical acclaim was phenomenal for the studio as well as for George. The question is exactly what you just stated. How do you better this? I mean, how do you. I mean, and George's fingerprints are all over the movie. And I've got to say, along with my friend Guy Norris, who's just got the most amazing brain for getting his head around complicated scenarios and action and stunts, I mean, the amount of prep that goes into that is just unbelievable. It certainly doesn't happen by accident. But yes, how do you make it better? And I guess the only way you make it better is by somehow coming up with a better story. That it is again character driven and story driven. I don't know how you would do better stunts than what we just saw. Now, that's not to say you can't, but boy, what a conundrum for George, because you certainly wouldn't want to go backwards,
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's also need to be done for the right reasons. I'm sure there's tons of pull on the people involved to go at it again, but you because there's money to be made, of course. But I really hope if they do pursue Mad Max again, I really hope it's for the right reasons because you guys got me as sort of a viewer that just doesn't get excited by, I'm sorry to say, an Avengers or things like that. It's just a painting to me nowadays. And
I'm with you. I'm with you,
I mean, the work is fantastic, but it's not for me anymore. It doesn't thrill me. When watching Fury Road, it was that I was not thrown back in this retro way. Oh my God, we're back to the 80s! Hurrah! But it was, this is for me. And my God, how can they do this in this day and age? But they did it. I mean, if you sit there and question, is that real? Is that CG? Is that real? Is that CG? I don't know. If you don't know, then you guys have definitely,
Well, it was real, and it's again, it's old school. It's what we would call old school. And I did the movie, and yet when we watched it for the first time, we were in Canada. A few of us went along, Guy included, of course, and we watched it in 3D. And oh man, it took my breath away. And I was so gave me goosebumps because I also know how hard it is doing a movie like that for everybody involved. George went through all the normal shit with budget restraints and everything else. And it was such vindication to see it turn out the way it did. And, when it started, and again, how simple. I mean, it's basically a truck that leaves one place, goes up to this place, turns around, comes back, but it was always meant to be like that, and it just worked. And it didn't stop. I mean, it never let you off the hook. When I thought, ah, it's starting to slow down, next minute the polecats appear, the guys on the long poles, and off it goes again. And it just worked in every way for me. I was thrilled. I hope to God they do another one, and I would love dearly to be involved in. Another one, the same as Suicide Squad. Suicide Squad, I'm so thrilled with in a different way. I mean, Will Smith, I've just become such a fan of Will. You could not meet a nicer guy and more of a team player than Will Smith. He's about everybody, not just making a film, but just having a phenomenal experience. He's uplifting. He's just so inclusive. And we were blessed with the whole cast. Margot Robbie is another Aussie. She was on a series called Neighbours, and what a dream. I mean, Margot did 99% of every bit of action. I said, Margot, I said, you're doing my head in. I could teach you just about any fight scene I could think of, and I reckon you could pull it off. not only because physically she gets it, but and she doesn't come from a physical background. That's the funny part about it. But she's so smart, intelligent. She just understands the direction and the beats and the drama within the fight. And, you know, will Jai Courtney and other Aussies, see the Aussies are taking over, mate.
Well, you have a wonderful legacy of being reckless madmen, but also like visionary filmmakers. You know, the stunt tradition in Australia, I don't know much of it, but it freaks me out, some of the stuff I've seen on celluloid in the 70s and 80s.
It's down and dirty, you know. It's harden up. Come on, get it done. But well, anyway, look, I just finished off Suicide Squad. It's been through Jared Leto. He concerned me because Jared is renowned as being such a method actor, and I was worried, wonder how safe Jared's going to be. Well, again, you couldn't meet a more professional and more intelligent actor. Was so concerned that he would be safe and everything he did was safe for Margot when he was working with her. And I just couldn't thank him enough for that. So once again, just a phenomenal experience working with David Ayer, and that cast was just, again, wow, what a blessing, especially at this stage in my life. As I said to you last year, I could have been thinking it's all over, and suddenly the ride starts again. You've gone up the top of that roller coaster and you're just heading down again.
Well, I sincerely hope it marks a new chapter in your professional life, and I sincerely hope you look after yourself also, sir, that you don't take on too much fun in one go from one fun to another, or two fun to another, or something.
Well,
like
you
that.
Know when you say that about George Miller, I noticed he said his next movie, he doesn't want there to be any stunts. It's going to be drama only. I think he just needs a bit of a...
I want to shoot a pig movie again.
This has been George's life. I had a meeting with George and Guy and everybody some 15 years ago about this Mad Max movie.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen. That was when Mel was going to do it. And then, no. And then 3 years before we shot this, we had meetings. It was all set to go. We did rehearsals in Broken Hill. No. Dollar change, whatever happens. And suddenly you get it done. But this is George's baby, and there is nobody more hands-on than George Miller. He's such a detailed man, and every rip in a costume, every mark on a vehicle, the tires, the this, the that, nothing was left to chance. It was all completely choreographed in George's mind, and I just got all the respect in the world for George, you know, as a filmmaker. So, again, to be around people like that and see how they work. Remember I said earlier it's about being around people at the top of their game. Well, it's definitely the case when you're around somebody like a George Miller.
Excellent. Well, it's a wonderful and inspiring ongoing career, both for him and for you certainly as well. And you know, to put a pin in it here, I mean, as cliched as it might sound, do you have like some words or a motto or a mantra to share with the audience that you've sort of carried with you through experiences that's sort of like energizes you and inspires you? So the floor is yours, Richard. Is there anything you want to leave us with?
Yeah, no, look, you know, my favorite sort of mantra now is, and my least favorite word in the English language is mediocrity.
Right. Yeah.
Whether I teach seminars or whatever, and I often refer in the same, you know, words in martial arts sense, that the world is full of mediocre people. It's full of mediocrity. And I just, you know, it's ever striving for that elusive excellence. You almost hope excellence is unattainable because it's about the journey and the striving for that excellence. And I've just been blessed to be around people like a Sammo or a Jackie or a George Miller or a Guy Norris or a Will Smith that absolutely understand that pursuit of excellence and never accepting mediocrity. So that's my biggest message to people. Whatever it is you do, it doesn't matter what it is, whatever is passion for you is what's important. It doesn't matter whether it's not your neighbor's cup of tea, you know, but and just go after it and just find something that makes you want to get up every morning. In other words, something that you're passionate about, because I feel that most adults, I say most, it's a bit of a generalization, are really living what I call previously learned skills. Like as a kid, you learn to play football and you learn to ride a bike, or you learn to write and you learn math, you go to school. But as an adult, most people are doing jobs that they could do in their sleep. They do the same thing day in, day out. They go home, they watch the same TV shows every night. They go to bed and then they get up and do the same thing all over again. what we do as a martial artist, or what I do as a martial artist, is I have the environment that allows me to learn something new every day I wake up. Being in the film world, giving you that same sort of environment. And what a blessing that is, to be continually stimulated every day, but not just stimulated and accepting the mediocrity. As I said, with martial arts, I've always said that to be the best, you have to just train with the very best.
Mm-hmm.
Because the one thing that happens in martial arts, people go, oh, if I, you know, I say to people, if I start going, oh, yeah, my jiu-jitsu is getting pretty good now, well, then I wrestle with my coach, Jean-Jacques Machado, and it's like, oh, okay, I'm down here and he's up there. Or I do kickboxing with Benny the Jet. Oh, that's right. He's up there and I'm down here. That's important. I think it's important to always understand and accept that you're a student. You're a student of life. You're a student in the areas that you're passionate in. If you accept that, then you're never going to stop learning, never stop improving, never stop growing. And that's what life is all about. It's about setting new goals all the time. Again, not setting mediocrity, not being happy enough with or complacent. You know, it's setting those new goals that, again, keep you striving towards excellence in the area that hopefully you're passionate in.
Excellent, excellent. I think that's an awesome way to go out. So thank you very much for talking to me, Richard. And
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to chat. It's a bit long-winded, some of it, but, you know, listen, it's been a fun journey and it hasn't ended. So maybe we can do this another 2 years. I've got a great project coming up and I'm not even allowed to tell you about it. But if you talk to me in a year, it'll be a very interesting story. And it's really a story involving coming full circle in my career. But we will talk again, my friend.
Now, that was a lovely day, all right, listeners. I really hope you enjoyed that. That was a thrill for me to be talking to Mr. Richard Norton. I mean, I was mostly a listener, as you heard, but what a guy, and what stories he has, and what kind of people he's been around. And the kind of theme you got from that chat, I hope, is that this is a guy through professionalism, but also being a good person, was rewarded. And sometimes the universe does pay you back by having such traits. And yeah, that was a lovely thrill. So hoping to reconnect with Richard indeed, and but also to continue this interview series in some way. I have some suggestions in terms of the persons I want to ask for an interview. You never know if they say yes or if they've heard of us. I don't imagine anyone has heard of us, really. But that was really, really fun, and I hope you enjoyed. And there's nothing else to say. Therefore, then, this has been Podcast on Fire at podcastonfire.com, where you'll have interviews, shows on Hong Kong cinema, Japanese cinema, Korean cinema, ninja, sleaze, and various amount of stuff, including bonus episodes. Email us if you have any feedback, podcastonfire@googlemail.com. Let us know if this was a good type of podcast, if you enjoyed this, what I can do better, and all of that. Like, I enjoy constructive criticism as long as it is constructive, but please let us know what you thought of this. podcastonfire@googlemail.com. At the top of the website you have links to our social media, the Facebook page and the Facebook group, and Twitter, as well as links to the iTunes feed, which you can rate and subscribe to and leave a comment on as well. If you're an iTunes user and Stitcher Radio, you can stream online, but also on their application, available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. And I write about Hong Kong cinema and a variety of genres at my site, sogoodreviews.com, and my video hub is sleazykvideo.com, and my Twitter handle is @sogoodreviews. So this has been Kenny B, and again, thank you very much to Mr. Richard Norton for agreeing to the interview and being very generous with his time and his answers. So see you next time, guys. Hope you enjoyed. Bye-bye.